Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Australian survivor.
Survivor
is
saved.
Survivor.
Survivor. 21
South Africans, 12 ordinary Australians.
15 New Zealanders.
$1 million.
Hello everyone, and welcome to RHAP's coverage of Survivor South Africa Champions episodes 3 and 4. I'm your host Shannon Gust, here to talk about episodes 3 and 4, as said. And to do that, I need to welcome in my co-host. So please welcome my colleague on my left, Mike Bloom. Mike, I know I had to diverge from the pair thing, but I love that quote so much from Bootleg that I had to introduce you that way.
Well, especially the fact that it's not her right, it's our right, right? She said the exact opposite of what she meant.
Right. And also just like the fact that she'd called Sonette her colleague. I've never heard like a contestant referred to as a colleague. And it felt very much like, I'm not your friend.
I think especially that was like the microcosm of her passive aggression with the whole Sonette stuff, right? Like this was after Sonette, she thought that Sonette had called her out. And so Bootleg's like, all right, I thought you weren't a friend. You've downgraded to acquaintance, and now you're just colleague. Just be glad I'm regarding you as a person right now. You're one step above dirt at the moment.
She better be, next time it's going to be like my enemy, which, look, I'm here for it. I'm here for that kind of relationship, you know, regressing as it does, because I just feel like the fire duel, which we just spoke about how much we loved last week, continues to be great. Like, the Shona-David pairing continues to be iconic. Bootleg and Sonette are also in this thing where they're tied to each other, but they don't want to be, and there's conflict there. Like, that is just the jewel that keeps on giving.
Yeah, I mean, it really shows, like, how much that fire challenge pays off in so many ways. You know, I think even though they got duped last time, Mark and Cornet, for good TV's sake, ended up making the complete right decision, because now we have this sort of, like, 3 days of the Sierra Madre relationship between David and Shona, where they explicitly do not trust each other, but are still in this alliance. And then you have Sonette and Bootleg, who throw each other under the bus at the first opportunity at Tribal Council, and it looks like there is more to come there. So, yeah, we thought last week, like, oh, this is such a fun opportunity to give, you know, the quote-unquote weaker players an advantage in the game, and maybe it fosters in an alliance initially. and ends up doing quite literally the opposite on both sides, considering that some of these players are still on the bottom, and now they outright have reasons to hate each other at this point.
Yeah, like, it creates a complex relationship between the people chosen and the people choosing them. Then there's a complex relationship between the two sets of pairs. Like, they each know that they have a clue, that something that could, you know, at a swap or a merge, that could come into play. And then these two people got one clue to share together. They didn't decide to go together. They got chosen together. And they either have to be in this, like, unlikely alliance, which doesn't seem like it's going great for Shona and David, or they won't, like, if they're not connected at all, then they just have this enormous distrust because they can't share this one clue between the two of them. So Fire Jewel continues to be a tick. In terms of the other two episodes that we actually watched this week, I think there was a lot to enjoy there. I think we're getting a lot of the different personalities in Mark and Cornet. I'm enjoying the fact that they seem like total opposites in every way, other than the fact that they both don't understand the game in different ways, but they definitely have in common.
It's that horseshoe theory, right? Like, eventually people that are sort of like at polar ends of the of a certain spectrum end up sort of being closer together than you may think. This is sort of Mark and Cornet, where, to your point, both of them don't know exactly how to play the strategic game of Survivor, but they're both going about that idea in completely different ways.
Yeah, I mean, and Mark is like such an animated person, and his confessionals are so animated. I'm actually enjoying both of them at this point, in like very different ways. Like, for Mark, I feel like he's doing so much wrong, and we'll talk about it. I'm like, how is it this hard? Like, you're not playing Survivor, and you're in conflict with so many people. What would happen if you were actually playing Survivor? Whereas, like, for Cornet, I feel like the way he's demurred is really interesting to me. Like, one of the funniest moments of these two episodes for me was the fact, like, when they came back having lost the next immunity challenge, and he, like, gave the speech, and this time he was like, you guys just do what you want. You know, like, after last time, they completely didn't listen to him. And he's like, I'm not even going to tell you what to do now.
It was a pretty incredible confessional.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as he came back from camp in episode 3, saying, so I realize I don't know much about the game.
Yeah.
You could just see, like, this image playing in his mind of, like, what would the sliding door situation be like if I'd agreed not to be on Survivor and essentially now get my pants pulled down in front of all of South Africa that I explicitly said do this and they didn't do that. We got a very similar idea from Xavion, you know, talking about, like, that's what I think, you know, the people that are a part of this. I was talking about this with you offline. This cast actually reminds me a bit of, like, millennials versus Gen X, in that it does seem that everyone is there to play the game and play the game hard. But at the same time, like, when they get got, there's not a lot of ill will, at least at the moment. And not to say that, like, that's the way Survivor should be played. Survivor is an emotional game, considering the elements naturally deplete you. But I do find it interesting that, you know, you have people that are blindsided in these votes, and then they come back to camp and it's just like, all right, it happened. Now I'm going to just wake up the next day and do what I do to try to make my way back into the game. You know, we don't get any Rupert-esque who the hell voted for me, at least so far.
Yeah, I mean, that could be enjoyable. Definitely, like, having emotion to me when you're blindsided, that's really interesting to me. Like, I like seeing kind of the passion of the game come out. But then there also is the benefit in just people who kind of take it on the chin. I remember in 2019, when I was covering at the same time AU 2019 and Survivor South Africa Season 7, they were so different. And the Ponderosas were, like, opposite things,
right.
Where Survivor South Africa Season 7 was, like, brutal and they hated each other and it was, like, must-watch television. And then AU 2019 was, like, enemies were friends, like, it was all in the game.
Let's sing Sweet Caroline songs to the next person coming in.
But the thing is, both things to me were enjoyable in different ways. Like, I'm happy to see them, like, kind of leave it all out on the court and be friends. Like, as you said, millennials versus Gen X, I mean, I'm interested in that. But then also when people, like, are emotionally invested, I'm really interested in that. So, I mean, I'm interested to see where it goes. I did enjoy kind of Xavion in that role of you got, let's see how the next two episodes go. And I kind of enjoyed his evolution, which is, I'm sure, something we'll talk about. Like, he had to literally have it explained to him, like, okay, we're allowed to align. Even though we're weaker, Cornet and Xavion, this is both of you, we are actually allowed to align. And the way that he even said, like, I'm bad at Survivor. Like, I was enjoying kind of people learning the game in that way. And I enjoyed a lot of this episode. I enjoy so much of the cast, but I just kind of want to say at the top here, like, there was a moment for me that kind of knocked me off my feet, like, with Van. And the blatant racism towards Kalani, like, actually just, like, shocked me to my core that it was so blatant. I think that's very much connected to that whole vote, which was, like, the main vote of the two episodes. So I think it's something we definitely need to talk about in the context of this season, in the context of Survivor at large, some of, like, the diversity protocols that are being put in for the U.S. and how more needs to be done then. And I think this was like a really good example of that, because it was shocking to me and very ugly to me, and the way that then Kalani then got voted out in a way that I think, again, is not connected to that kind of thing, upset me greatly. So I want to talk about that, but not have the whole podcast kind of get bogged down in it while still giving it its due, because there's also so many great moments, 99% great cast, and you suck, I hate you. And I want to talk about kind of all those things and kind of include it all in the podcast. And that's just where my head is at this point.
Well, yeah. So let's, you know, I don't want to necessarily say like, oh, let's replay this moment. But I can imagine that there are some people out there who may not have exactly caught the incident that you were referring to, because, you know, it was an incident where Zan was talking about Killarney, not to her face. He was talking about her behind her back. This is when Sonette approaches him in episode 4, essentially telling him like, hey, just so you know, Killarney's trying to get together the votes against you. And Zan outright says, like, that's why you don't trust an Indian woman. And then he proceeds to go into a very derogatory impression of a very stereotypical Indian person. And so, considering that what we see is just a mere moment's glance at 2 days of footage, it does unfortunately open the imagination as to not only probably some of the horrendous stuff that Zan was saying about Killarney, about her nationality specifically behind her back, but also why that might have been an additional reason why Killarney was so gung-ho about going after Zan, even if you have other players, including people in her alliance, saying, like, this is not a good idea.
Yeah, I think there's a lot we need to talk about with that, because Killarney is going to go home here, I think, largely by her own hand. And I think we can talk through the reasons that this didn't work for her. When it worked for Graham last week, for example, to kind of, like, create this insurgency plan, I think that it was, like, she was kind of doing the wrong thing. Graham was doing things right. And also, I think the majority did way better here for Shane and Marion than Xavion did last week. But then again, it's like, you can't really blame Killarney. Like, there was this personal break between them where they seemed to see each other as, like, the two workers. And then she was, like, very offended that he called out her bed, which was, like, what she'd done for the tribe in front of both tribes. And that's the personal break that we saw. But I'm just saying, like, whether she's picking up on it or not, whether there's an energy there, if someone can say that about you and be so hateful towards you behind your back and be so racist towards you, that's not a safe place for her. And like, whether in what capacity she's picking that up, I don't know. But I'm just saying there's a very different thing between Shane hating Zan and being able to put up with him and kind of keep him on a leash and take him through further in the game, when Zan's not saying that about Shane behind his back. Like, credit to Shane, but I'm just saying, like, we have to acknowledge that privilege, because for Killarney, she's desperate to get Zan out. It's not the right move. It's not something anyone else wants to do. She ends up being the only person voting for him. But that's a different situation when someone can be that hateful about you behind your back, or, you know, that is seeped into their relationship. And I just think that we kind of need to acknowledge the fact that when she's making those moves, going after Zan, the strong guy that no one wants to go for, no one in her own alliance, no one in the other alliance, like, she's preaching to the choir that he's terrible. Like, she's giving all the reasons that he should go, which is, like, he's a horrible human. And everyone's like, I agree. But everyone else has accepted that they can deal with that. She can't deal with that in a personal way. And I think when you see the way he talks about her, you have to give that merit. And that's why it just made me so upset, because I'm like, she's doing the wrong thing logically and she's doing the wrong thing strategically. But, like, when you put people like that in the game with her and put her in that position, it becomes hard not to make the personal thing, because your safety and your comfort is first. Like, that should come first over strategy. And unfortunately, she goes home because of that. And it makes me so sad that that happened to her. And it makes me so sad for anyone who was triggered having to watch that, even though I commend the show for putting it in, which is something we'll talk about. But yeah, it floored me. I'm not going to lie. Like, watching that second half, like, it knocked me off my feet.
It's tough, you know, because again, I think if Survivor were scripted, this would be like everyone turning on Zan. Like, what did you say about her? Let's get rid of the racist here. But unfortunately, as we have seen as recently as Survivor US 39, when you sometimes leave people to sort of, like, again, create their own social experiment, it's not a devout social experiment in that there is sort of a monetary end goal and a game perspective to it. And I think you bring up a great point in that certainly people can say, like, well, I can divorce my emotions from my strategy. You know, just because you hate someone, you should still be able to take them to the end if it benefits your game. That's all well and good, but I think there is a clear delineation between that and, like, having to be at camp with someone who makes you uncomfortable. And again, I don't want to necessarily, you know, project onto Killarney that, like, she was, you know, feeling uncomfortable with stuff that Zan was saying about her. But that being said, and this is, you know, I know the diversity initiatives, which you spoke about, have been put into place. But before that, in the wake of season 39, there were some new stipulations with regards to, you know, comfort and harassment, essentially saying like, hey, now on the show, if you do not feel comfortable, you know, we're going to weigh whether or not that person should stay in the game. And so I think it should be said, you know, if there was a moment, and I don't know if there was a moment out on the island where Killarney felt uncomfortable that Zan was saying things about her, whether in front of her or behind her back, production should and could have removed him there. But, you know, again, it might have been different circumstances. It might have been much murkier circumstances. But I hope, and I think it's safe to say that I think in an environment now where, to your point, you know, the diversity initiatives are a step, but progress is a staircase. Equality is a staircase. And so we are only one step on there, and a big key step that might still be broken in the you know, aspects of reality TV are bringing on problematic people who may create drama, but also have implicit and explicit biases that directly influence not only their own gameplay, but the people around them. And to your point, this very clearly shows, you know, I don't exactly know the ratios on this cast, but it does look like a very ethnically diverse cast at first glance, and you still have someone like Zan who makes comments like this. You know, though going for diversity and hearing from a bunch of different people that you might not hear from originally is an incredible goal to go for, it is not the cure-all, it is not the panacea, and it is a stark reminder that when it comes to, you know, giving everyone a fair shot of being perceived in the game and having a chance to play the game proper, we still have a little bit more to go.
Yeah, I mean, Zan is a racial minority in the game. He's a racial minority in South Africa. And still that white privilege comes in when it's so easy to jump to that ugly racism thing as an easy target. So that just shows, like, we talked about, like, the 50-50 diversity protocols that the US is bringing in, and this season passes that, but it's not enough, because you have to be able to not cast bigots, and if it's not identifiable, you have to be able to remove them from the game. Even though it might seem like, oh well, he didn't say it to her face, like, this is a guy who holds these views, and now you know that in no uncertain terms. And it's, you can't self-police really in the game of Survivor, as you talked about from right. season 39, like, they kept Dan around because why were they not? This guy couldn't beat anyone. Like, there's so much incentive to keep him to the end. Someone like Zan, there's incentive to keep him very far. He obviously brings strength and also...
Their names even sound similar.
Yes. Ugh, I'm not... Yeah. I mean, we're not making a pun out of these two. As Zan's top would say, dope. He is dope. You can't self-police that, because it's different when it's happening to you. Like, for Kelly, she needed Dan out of the game. For everyone watching it, it was like, well, that's unfortunate, but, like, in my quest for $1 million, it's helpful for me to be in the game. The only one who's outside of that is production, to be like, no, you have to go. And that's why I advocated at the time that Dan should have been removed already by then at the merge. And for Zan, like, you know, like, he says it to Sinette. Sinette can't call him out, like, on Survivor, like, when he has more power than her. I mean, she laughed pretty hard. It was uncomfortable. I don't know what her reaction would have been in the real world, but you can't call that out there. There's no self-policing. This isn't even normal society, in which probably calling out doesn't happen enough, but it's like, you all have to play nice because you're all in the strategic game. So the only one who can police that is production, and they got to be policing that. At the same time, I do commend the show for airing it, because I don't think the US would have done that. I've heard that they've hidden some other really ugly things. It made it a less pleasant viewing experience, for sure. It was ugly. It made the vote go from something just strategic to something very real and shocking, but at the same time, I'm grateful that they did it, because I feel like that accountability and that progress to a degree and that transparency of, like, this is who Zan is, he said it on camera, all is fair game, this is why Killarney might be feeling this way, these are the dynamics. I think as much as that might have been triggering for some people and that breaks my heart, for me and my privilege, it was definitely, like, the right thing to see and to have my viewing experience be very real, as much as it was a much more uncomfortable viewing experience for me watching such blatant racism in front of my face.
Yeah, it was interesting, because I think, like you said, if you look at the voting chart, you blame Killarney for, like, oh, it's, you know, what was it, 5-4 or 6-3-1, like, you were way out there, what were you doing? But I do think the show, between that or even, like, you know, Shane and Marion being like, wow, she's a big threat, you know, she's getting some claws, and we want to, you know, essentially put her down before she tears into us. I think they did an okay job building her up as, like, you know, the reason why she's going is not because she's bad at the game of Survivor necessarily. And I do think, to your point, it does provide a substantive reason if you read behind the lines as to why she was so gung-ho about Zan. It might not have just been about the beds. And maybe another reason is that the show, I think, has bailed on Zan, or at least bailed on giving any sort of redeeming edit to Zan, much like Zan himself has sort of bailed on giving himself any sort of redeeming edit by just being such a stickler around camp, or even, like, you know, basically going on a boycott or doing anything for anybody else, which you would think in a social strategy game like Survivor is not a good idea. But depending on the people you're playing with, when you're playing with people like Shane and Marianne who have dollar signs in their eyes, it makes you even more appealing to be kept around.
Yeah. And again, like, such a credit to them. But again, for someone like Shane, we do just have to acknowledge the privilege to be able to do that. And I think that seeing this here was really interesting to me because, like, every country has its own experience with race and bigotry. And I think what I've loved to see from Survivor South Africa is, like, the incredible diversity of South Africa, like the cultures and the languages and, like, everything that we get to see from it is amazing. And the three casts that I have seen from Survivor South Africa, I think all three are, like, truly excellent. Like, I've loved seeing, like, these different South African personalities. And then there's that other side of that, like, which every country has in its own way, that, like, hatred. And we just saw it in such stark and bladed terms that it, as I've said, just completely shocked me. So I think that was a hard one because it does end in Kalani going. And as you said, if Survivor scripted, Zan's getting, like, the downfall edit here. But that's just not going to happen because he is helpful for the tribe, and because he can't do anything, like, it makes sense for Shane and Marion to keep him around, because what is this guy going to do? He has, like, no strategic pull. He'll never have any social capital. Like, definitely keep him around.
Nobody wants to work with
Everyone
him.
Everyone, like, hates him.
Yeah, like, there's a majority alliance after this, but there's a chance maybe, you know, Zan, if he really wanted to, could go to people like a Sully, you know, or a Bootlay and be like, hey, I want to work with you. But nobody likes him at this point. He is so socially ostracized himself that he has also strategically ostracized himself. We talk so much about how those two sort of go hand in hand, and in cutting off one of his hands, he's essentially cut off his other one as well.
I know, and that's what was sad about it, is that it made it such a bad move for Kalani. I think, like, yeah, she was worked up as a threat, but at the same time, like, take all of this personal stuff aside, which you can't, which is why it's fine, but I'm just saying, if you look at it just, like, on paper, this was not the right move for her. And to compare it to, like, Graham, for example, like, if Graham last week had gone against Xavion, then it wouldn't have worked. Like, if she'd gone against Annette here, which is what the rest of her alliance wanted to do, like, maybe she could have got the numbers. Maybe she could have at least gotten five, or, like, got something going there. But Zan is not the right move because he is a pawn in the game, because he is strong. Everyone hates being around him, but, like, at this point, he's like a goat if you're willing to take him that far, which I doubt they are, because they're all, like, it's very early in the game. And I know it's only 27 days, but they're all already, like, completely over it with him. But for now, like, they can handle it. So to go for Zan is completely the wrong move there. Like, she's, as I've said, preaching to the choir on why he should go, which is that he's terrible. They're like, no, we agree that he's terrible, but we can take it. So that's not going to help. So she has to pivot to a different target, which would have been Sinet. And as we discussed last week, like, Graham was in a really good position to do that, kind of in his archetype of this, like, alpha male who's, like, strong. Like, that's the time when you can kind of be loud, get your ducks in a row early in the game. For strong women, not great to do that early in the game. And if she just done nothing, it at least would have been Vel. But to speak up in that archetype early is classically not great for you. So again, like, that's not really her position to be doing that. I still think it might have been gone better with Sinet. But you could see Shane was like, oh, she's, you know, the one kind of pulling the strings. I don't like that. She's, you know, creating, like, a counter plan. She came across as too strong. And then the third thing is that Shane and Marion have done so much better than the alliance did last week. You know, to actually have a majority of at least five, maybe six players, to have no clear pecking order.
I was going to say, to make sure that, like, they are the top two, but they're not letting anyone know.
They're actually very rarely seen together
in a group setting. Like, they do a fantastic job of, like, giving each other marching orders and then sort of dividing and conquer.
Yeah.
To that point, I think it is also helped by the fact that, like, you know, last week, when Graham was sort of forming, I guess, what is now known as the Rugrats Alliance, I don't think anyone was really, like, going to bat for Ashley. You know, nobody was like, oh, yeah, we got to keep Ashley around. You know, I really have plans for Ashley in my game. This was not the case this time around. And I think that also helped Shane and Marion, too. Right. That, like, yeah, the two of them, you even have someone like Sully, who's on the other side of things, but is like, hey, I still want to keep Zan around. And I think the choice of target, to your point, is very, very key. You know, you want to pick someone that when you're forming an alliance, everyone can at least be a little okay with. If someone speaks up against it, they're not going to be inclined to vote that way, especially at the very first vote. So I think, unfortunately, you know, Killarney, whether you want to say lucked out or not, she did not benefit from the fact that her choice of target, understandably so, but still with somebody who, you know, when she's going to someone like Marion with the plan, Marion's like, well, actually, I want to work with Zan, so I'm going to have to decline your offer, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, Graham's in the position where he doesn't need Xavion to go. Like, he's not having this, like, extreme personal conflict with him. And as we've said, it went even further here. And that's where it gets so murky, because Ashley is the Sinnet. Like, if they'd been willing to go for a weaker person, I still don't know if it would have hurt, if it would have worked, because, you know, Shayna Marion had the ducks in a row so well.
Yeah, I mean, it really would have come down to WWSD, what would Cebu do? Yeah. Like, it seemed like he was really the kingmaker in this position.
Yeah, I think that it at least would have been a better pitch, maybe to kind of get the whole tribe on the same page and not like create like a split right down the middle. But I still think like Marion and Shane don't need a compromise. Like, they're in control. They have an individual relationship with Sinnet. They have a majority. They probably could have just pulled Cebu over instead of making him go to a tie. So they were in a really good position. Like, the fact that they are the central pair, but I don't think it's obvious. The fact that they each have their individual relationships, like, they've made it happen really well. So Killarney anyway was kind of against this big force. Probably the thing to do was just nothing. Let Val go. Hope that you get through to a swap or a merge at that point when you're kind of on the outside looking in. But she went and tried to actually make a plan, which in her demographic, not great. And then she chose the worst target for these personal reasons that no one was going for. And then it was just like she was completely out. So it was an unfortunate thing. I was hoping somehow for Cebu to pick the other alliance. Like, I like some people in each one. With Zan, even though he wasn't going to go, like, it kind of felt like if Sinnet had gone, it would have been like the closest thing to like the good guys winning out.
Right. Yeah. It's like sort of like Zan won, even though, again, like, he is being dragged along without realizing it. You know, he still technically ends up surviving and gets rid of his most vocal opponent. So it does feel like very ugly in a way, like he ends up sort of, you know, winning the day in a manner of speaking.
Yeah, and the fact that it happened in this episode where like the alliances are drawn like largely across racial lines as well, I just thought that there was a lot of intrigue there. But for Zan to stay and for his alliance to win out, for his opponent to go, for Killarney to go, like, it felt like the good guys were losing, even though I totally understand why Cebu did it. So yeah, I just kind of came away with like a little bit of sadness from that episode. But otherwise, I want to talk about like the fun stuff from the episode, but I just feel like we have to get that out there because this stuff was very, very real. And I think definitely pointed like such an incredibly specific picture of what people need to be looking for when they like creating diverse casting. The fact that like 50-50 is clearly not enough. And like, if people are bigots, don't cast them. And if you find out too late, eject them. And I think we saw it here, and I think almost like every production team should have to watch this episode, I feel, to see like how this can be impactful, even when it's not to someone's face. Like, it has meaning. Don't believe that this stuff happens outside of those comments. Don't believe that Van's feelings don't matter in his relationships with these people, even if it's not to their face. Like, it matters. It's there. Production should be watching it of why it's so tangible. And I just absolutely think that we just saw it happen here, and I'm glad we've been able to speak about it because it feels very important now and then.
Yeah, it was definitely something that I think very much stuck out to me more so in my second time watching this. And I think it's because I have become more awakened to my own privilege and maybe interactions and implicit biases and microaggressions that I did not notice prior. And it was not a good look at all for really anybody. And to your point, I'm hopeful that we'll see better days behind this, and there'll be more attention paid to small interactions like this, because they accumulate like a snowball until much bigger incidents. But let's move on from the ugliness. Let's talk about the beauty of the blind side here, Shannon, because I mean, look no further than like how much of a rockin' start this season is off to, that these two tribes, first tribal councils, both result in, you know, lopsided votes, but leaves like a third of the tribe pretty much blindsided as a result.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to start talking about the positive, like, I want to talk about Cebu, who I love. I feel like between the idol stealing, which we'll talk about, and then Mark, Fish, and him fighting, where I was, like, totally team Cebu, I was like, we need to protect this guy at all costs. And he's in this, like, swing vote position, but it's, like, it's not a swing vote, because if he voted with the other side, it would have been a 5-4-1, and he would have put himself in the minority for no reason.
The confessional that Cebu gave about him, quote-unquote, being in the middle was really just, like, all right, either I'm part of the majority and I like it slightly less, or I'm in the minority and I like it slightly more. And it's like, if you really map it out like that, you could very much tell where he's going. But I mean, we talked about this last week a bit. The fact that he was in that position says a lot about the relationships that he's been making and his strengths. You know, I don't want to keep going back to this draft, but I worried, especially in a game that was captained by these professional athletes and brings in professional athletes from time to time, which we will certainly get to, that like physical weakness would initially get targeted. Seloton did away with that immediately, but I was fearful for someone like Sivu, who was the last man picked and the second to last overall picked in the game. But it seems like Sivu is being regarded as such a social and strategic asset. And I will admit, he might have been, if I looked at this entire cast, he might have been the person I thought would have been the least biggest fan of Russell Hands. But it turns out he loves the guy.
I love that. I love that he like would shout out the US show. And like, we'll talk about the idol feeling, but that's why I really didn't like it. I was like, he found that it was so happy. It's kind of like watching someone's idol get nullified. Like to see it get stolen was just like, broke my heart. I think it also mattered because I love Sivu. Like, if Zan had his idol stolen, I'd probably be like, I like this rule. Like, good job.
Yeah, that's the fun thing with every twist, right? Like, oh, Hot Cop Dan gets nullified. That's fine. Janet gets nullified. How dare you? This twist needs to burn in the fire.
Yeah, and I can, like, acknowledge that bias as well. Like, yeah, I mean, I know that that's true. No, I would hate the idol stealing anyway, but I definitely would accept it if it was someone like Zan.
So yeah, let's talk about it. So I'm not sure, Shannon, were you in the know prior to this?
Yeah.
That the fact that this idol stealing rule was a thing for the season.
I had heard this. Like this was like this was pretty much like 27 days, two captains who don't play, and idol stealing. Those are the three things. Are you wondering why it's taking me so long to watch it? Like if someone had said meet Sivu, I think I probably would have watched a little earlier, but I was hearing like all of the things that made me kind of raise my eyebrows before. And seeing it on TV, I still did not like it.
Yeah, I really am not a fan. It just feels weird, and not in like the unconventional weird that is like Zan making a hammock out of the tribe flag. It was so weird to me to get a shot of the Utara like tribe flag frame without the flag in it. And then the fact that Zan was sleeping on it, it felt oddly unconstitutional. But I think it's also just like, I think it's bad TV personally, because the reason why hidden immunity idols were put in the game in the first place were like, to help the underdogs, right? Like if it was going to be a clear vote for somebody, there's still a chance that they can pull out an idol and save the day. But now you are nullifying that chance of that underdog prevailing by being like, oh, they just found an idol. Great. I'm going to go in and steal it. And I'm pretty sure you can go through someone's bag to take their idol as well.
It's a weird one because it's like, so it makes the nature of idol finding now it becomes where like, idol hiding is actually more important. Like every single person finds
like,
the idol.
You found it, but good luck keeping it on your person or else because people are going to come, you know, in the night with their sticky hands.
It's a very different thing now because now it's like if you find it, it's not set in stone. What it actually means is like you're like one part on the chain of like this pass the bomb kind of or like a positive bomb.
Really, it's like hot potato. Yeah. But it's cold potato because that's what you want. Lukewarm potato, I suppose.
Now like hiding the idol is more important than finding it, and bag searching is probably like the most important part of idol hiding. Like, is that what people are looking to want from finding idols? Like, I mean, I'm not used to it, so I don't think so. It was just like such a head scratcher for me that Sivu could have the note, but not the idol. Like, how?
And even like, you know, it screws over the situation of like if an underdog finds it now, you know, they lost their get out of jail free card. But if an overdog finds it, you know, maybe there's a chance that somebody steals it back, but probably not because that overdog is probably like using it in a different way than just sort of like hoarding it. And also, I think, you know, it creates the idea of like, OK, I guess if you want to keep this idol on you, you have to like hide it on your person for the rest of the game. And like nobody wants Nico Panaggio does not want your crotch smelling idols. OK, and you're creating crotch smelling idols with this rule. You're basically forcing people to be like, all right, I guess you better duct tape this thing to your body for the next 24 days or else someone's going to snatch it off of you.
I mean, yeah, my mind hadn't gone to that place, but like fair enough that yours did. I was thinking more like, hey, so possession is like 10 tenths of the law here. Like, won't people be wrestling over idols? Like, if all it is to steal it, like, what if you find it in someone's bag and someone's like, hey, that's my idol in my bag. And they're like, no, it's in my hands. Like, won't they be wrestling? Won't they be wrestling
like,
for these idols?
Generally speaking, it's my, I touched it. I placed one fingertip on it. Therefore, it is my idol now.
It feels, I mean, like, and also in the other franchises, sometimes it can be murky. Like when people find it together, it's like, whose idol is it? But then you kind of have to like agree on whose it is, I think. Whereas like,
yeah, well, and it can also be like a whoever first touched it, essentially, it's their idol.
Okay. I feel like the touching the idol should not have as much power as it did anyway. But now I just genuinely feel like you could get like the entire tribe in like a death grip over this idol because it's like possessionless. Like its possession is so fleeting. It makes me feel anxious.
Yeah. And I think, you know, poor Sivu here, I do wonder, so he had the idol note. I wonder if the idol note said that they could be stolen, you know, and if it did, that brings into question further why he decided to leave it behind. I guess he just really was not suspecting of the fact that someone like Shane was sort of like lurking in the water, watching what he was doing, even though he did not seem the most inconspicuous at all, just sort of like lankily walking away from camp and everyone knew he was looking for idols. So I guess he's sort of paid for that hubris in a bit of a way. But I mean, the rich kept getting richer on Atara in that, you know, even though Sivu was the deciding vote, Shane and Marion are now firmly in control and they have an idol in their pocket. Who knows who's going to come pilfering those pockets soon.
For sure, like having an idol in your pocket means nothing. Someone just can put their hand in your pocket. You don't have an idol anymore. It's really trippy to me. Like Sivu, he did a lot right and he did a lot wrong. Like he was so obvious going for it that Steven was like, don't do that. And then also he did find the idol without a clue. Like that was good. But then he left it there. Like, was this something he knew about? Is this like a rule that they knew that it could be stolen? In which case that was dicey. Also, was this on the previous four seasons? Again, I can't Google it. I think Sarah Carradine said that she would be my Googler. She could Google for me if this was on the first four seasons of Survivor South Africa. I'm very interested in that.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I don't believe so. I would not be surprised if it was brought in for this season because of like the pirate theme, right? As Rupert would say, pirates pilfer, pirates steal. So like, I would not be surprised if like, well, you are all dirty pirates for this season, and so you could steal the idols. But luckily, thankfully, with the series reboot, this rule has been retired. So we only have to deal with it for this season. But yeah, not a very fun part of Survivor, considering that, yes, it might create like one gotcha moment on TV, but I feel like it unravels so much more than it actually ravels.
Yeah, that's like the one thing I'm not enjoying about the pirate thing. I love all the other pirate stuff that they're doing in this like dual sports pirate theme. It's like a weird hybrid for the theme of the season.
Yeah, you know, when the pirates, on their downtime, they kick soccer balls into the sail net.
I love how they're trying to combine it. Like, honestly, I commend it. But I'm much more into the pirate theme than the sports theme.
I will say, the challenges are out of this world.
Love it.
They are like Australian Survivor levels of epicness, and especially it's combined that with like US Survivor levels of set design. It's really a match made in heaven.
Yeah, I mean the Pearl Islands vibes, like the Burning Man was so cool, the shipwrecks are all amazing. Like definitely loving the pirate style production. We'll talk about the new captains coming in, which was like kind of its own thing. But like in terms of the idol, like, obviously props to Shane. He like had the awareness to look for it, he found it. It's not like his fault that it's like a terrible outcome to root for. And then he's like hiding it well, like he says to Steven, I doubt idols are even in play, which I guess is like a bit of a line, but it seems to be working for him. But like on the converse of that, can we talk about how like Sanette had the clue, didn't find the idol in time, and
production made us know how bad of a decision that was, because I'm pretty sure after all of this, I think Sanette gets like the Survivor essay version of the Dodo music as she is fruitlessly searching for an idol that she will never find.
This clue is not good for Sanette. Like it's created a massive division with Bootlay, who is going to out you / blackmail you because you won't give the clue to her. And also you were too late and didn't find the idol. Not only did you not find the idol, like two people found it before you. Like it wasn't just one person. You are third that we know
of. It was a lose-lose. Like at least if you had gone up on your own, you may have the chance of having an idol. But instead now you don't have an idol and everyone either thinks you have an idol and doesn't trust you or just doesn't trust you, period.
Yeah, and now you've got Bootlay calling you her colleague. Like it's not a good vibe for Sanette. So the idol stuff, yeah, I mean, I had not thought of it from a pirate perspective, but I guess that is what they're trying to do. For Sivu in general, like, I'm just hoping for the best here because I feel like it's nice to be wanted and, like, great social game that everyone wants to work with you. And it's just going to be on how he can kind of clean up the vote from here, because he's either going to come back to, like, some pissed off people because he's the person who let them down, or he's going to be able to say, like, you guys didn't have the numbers, like, what was I meant to do? And hope that he can keep those good relationships with everyone. Like, I'm definitely rooting for him and hoping that he can do that. I just hope it doesn't, like, come back to bite him.
I mean, I don't know. I think he might be okay. Because I think what he's able to benefit from and what the best flippers in Survivor do is they usually don't flip singularly. right? Yeah. Like, that's what made
Well, that's interesting that you say that, Mike, because I've got an upcoming podcast. I may look into this more closely, but no, please give me the spiel. Yeah,
well, I think that's one of the reasons why Tony's game in Kaga and particularly was so interesting and so, you know, hailed, is because he always flipped every time he did with Wu. So it's not
Look, I'm here sitting with my Rob Has a Podcast headphones on Rob Has a Podcast, employed by Rob Has a Podcast. Like, don't credit Tony when it was like Robin Mateo many, many seasons earlier.
Well,
like,
yeah, I'm not saying that Tony was the first, but I think that's an interesting example in that, like, people were getting pissed off at Tony every time they went off at camp, but Tony could very easily foist it onto Wu as well, being like, I was not the only one. You see him try to do that in his speech to his final Sharp Council speech to Trish of like, well, Wu was already going to flip, so I felt like I might as well join him. I think that Cebu could very easily make an argument to Bootle and Val and Sully, basically being like, first, A, Killarney was voting Zan, so we would have been screwed anyway, and B, like, it seemed like Marion was with Killarney, and she ends up voting as well. So I do feel like, even though from our perspective, Siva was the one in the middle, I don't know if from the tribe's perspective, he was the only one to flip. And I think that's going to help him a bit. Not to mention the fact that, like, if he does earn their ire, it does seem like this majority is pretty ironclad, or at least Sibu's not on the bottom, right? He's definitively above Zan. So even if they go to tribal council a couple more times and they don't aim directly at this minority of voters, he still has people within the alliance that will go over him.
Now, he's in a good spot for staying in the game. I just don't want him to, like, kind of go to a swap or emerge with any enemies because he had to make this decision just because everyone wanted to work with him. Like, he called it the easy move, and it's like, yeah, flipping to the minority in a vote you would lose would be the hard move on the first vote. So this was the easy move.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it was very straightforward, you know, on paper. I think it's tough, though, to your point. Like, it's easy to write down that pen to paper. The tough part is going to be coming back and having, you know, Bootle and Val and Sully being like, what happened, Cebu? But I also think what's going to help him is, as we'll see next time, apparently, like, the whole Sunette Bootle stuff. Bootle is going to have her own stuff going on. That maybe that's just going to distract everybody and nobody will notice, you know, quiet little Cebu now being able to blend into the background.
Yeah, I hope so. Like, I mean, as you said, Killarney had Marion's name in there, and I'm really interested in kind of this partnership of Shane and Marion and how they're doing. They have their different roles, and I think it's good for both of them. Like, Shane is the one who always gets his name. Like, he wanted Val first, it was going to be Val. Then he wanted Killarney, it was Killarney. Like, he's stepping into that, like, leadership role, and I think he gets more heat back. Like, you could see Killarney was more mad at him, but was including Marion in the plan. Marion is sitting back a bit, creating the personal relationships and getting the heat off her. I think early in the game, as we've talked about from a demographic standpoint, they're in the roles that they should be from that perspective. Like, Shane has the idol as well. Like, all these things that make you threatening, but you can kind of take that threat level when you're in that demographic. Whereas, like, you know, as a woman, you might want to just kind of put your plans in motion for later in the game, create those relationships, but have a shield in front of you, which I think Marion is doing incredibly well. I just love the way Marion is going about this. Like, I think it was her conversation with Sunette. I mean, you gave her a cheesy point for her conversation with Sivu last week. And I would just say, like, to add to that, her combination with Sunette, like, no one seems to distrust her. She seems to have, like, really an ability to make people feel confident about her. I just love her tact. I think she's going about it brilliantly.
And I think what also helps is, again, I'm making assumptions here, but it does seem like Shane and Marion's plans are like, okay, we're going to buddy up with our own genders. Mm-hmm. And while that might seem...
Marion had Sivu as well, to be fair.
Yeah, but I also think that is a good idea on this particular tribe, right? Because that might not fit in with other tribes, but like Utara in particular, the guys are... You know, especially Zan and Sully are like kind of beefy meatheads, and for lack of a better term.
I think that's fair to Sully, honestly.
They were arm wrestling on a crate, okay? When you're reenacting over the top, I have a right to call you a meathead, at least a smidge of it. But I do think that Shane might be able to gel with that aspect and bro down a bit more than Marion. And on the converse, like you said, Marion seems to have fantastic empathy. Especially for like people like Sunette. And so I do think she is employed well as too, you know, making the more, I think, grounded pitches to people like Killarney, just being like the listening ear to her, going to Sunette, as you said, really great scene there where she's like, I've got you. You don't need to panic. And essentially like cementing Sunette's place in that alliance, which essentially now cements their majority so crucially. So there are differences in tactics. Honestly, I know you said that the whole David and Shona thing, which we'll get to, is like one of the most fun unorthodox pairs we have in the game. I think very early on, Shane and Marion are proving to like be one of the most effective twosomes we have seen, especially early on in a season of Survivor.
Yeah, and obviously I was expecting to call you the Shane to my Marion this week. I just like, once you said the colleague line, I was like, I'm done. I have no other choice.
Listen, I think and hope we'll have many more weeks for you to call me the Shane to your
I'll
Marion.
I'll do it on another week where I can't think of another good one.
Yeah, keep it in your pocket unless someone steals it from your pocket.
Yeah. Well, two question mark Zan moments, like not to talk so much about like he should not be named, but like firstly, why did he want Solly gone? They kept saying like Zan wants Solly. Like,
yeah,
what?
That was interesting. Yeah, because when he hears about the Kill Arnie, he's like, oh, well, I was going to vote off Solly first. And that's interesting because we heard Solly's perspective last time, right, where he's like, listen, I don't like Zan, but I'm going to keep him around so I can like use him and then abuse him and then get rid of him. I don't know if Zan was feeling like a very similar rivalry with Solly in terms of like jockeying for the alpha male position.
I totally think that. I think Zan was threatened.
And maybe Zan was jealous that like Mark kept going to Solly to do all these things. He was his ringer in all the challenges. So I could very much imagine that Zan's like, you know, Solly's coming for my crown. I'm going to make sure that he gets thrown out of the kingdom right now. But he realizes like, oh, you know, he might do it next time. But for now, there's no reason to go after Solly when it's, you know, the devil. In this case, it's the devil, you know, versus the devil you don't.
Yeah, I mean, to quote Boston Rob, he's a little Zan. So I totally get him being threatened and wanting to take out like the other strength in the tribe. When like you're only being kept for your strength, like maybe don't go after strength and make people think like it would, I guess, make him more important. But if you're going to start the ball rolling on like we don't need strength, then like no one's going to keep you around. You're on thin ice anyway, buddy. Like, come on.
It's interesting, though, because I would say that I think in general, the idea of strength is out the window. Not to say that like Ashley, you know, was voted out because of her weakness. But Marsha and Killarney, I would say, were two of the strongest women in the game, period. Yeah. And they were voted out. So I think it shows. And it also, I mean, we look at like, you could say, oh, yeah, you're really hobbling yourself by doing that. But first off, I would give all the credit to Courtney and Mark for apparently picking like incredibly evenly balanced tribes from a schoolyard pick.
Because production, you know,
there's not an Ulog situation going on, but like every single challenge so far, the tribes have been neck and neck. Or some portion. There's never really been a blowout in any case. So it's almost like, you know, yeah, we can get rid of someone who's strong, but we have enough strong people that like we're going to be fine. And we saw that, you know, Cornet was griping about getting rid of Marsha, and then Solitan goes on to win the next two challenges.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I would push back on saying strength is out the window. Like, I do think that there's like the peak level of strength being like basically the big strong guy. Even if you're like athletic and strong, you might go. But if you're like the Xavion, like you saw, like he wasn't even in contention. I definitely think if strength wasn't a thing, the votes would have been split on Marsha and Xavion, not on Marsha and Philip. And Zan here, I think, is largely being kept for that reason. So I think it's there still, but only for like the biggest, strongest men.
Yeah, I would say it's not as big as like Australian Survivor by comparison, where it's like, okay, there are specifically one-on-one challenges where you need as many big guys as possible. I do agree with you that I think there are reasons why those guys are being kept around. But I would not say, you know, if it's like, oh, we have to, you know, we can't vote this person out, they're strong. They're inclined to go with that philosophy less in these first four episodes, I'm feeling.
Which is a miracle, given the hybrid sports pirate theme. Another question mark moment from Zan is like when he went to Steven, he's like, I'm thinking Kalani or Marion. And Steven's like, well, not Marion. Like, how bad is your read on the game that you would do that? Just want to say, I was just laughing so hard at that. Steven was just like, We're not gonna go for Marion, but like that was like the only time her name was mentioned. I just like wanted to point that out. Can we talk about Mark Fish? Because we spoke about it a bit at the beginning. I'm getting the different personalities from him, and I feel like there was a lot of Mark Fish moments in these first two episodes where I was very confused about the way he was going about things.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Cornet is the type of person who doesn't know how to play Survivor, and as a result, kind of like lays down and dies. Mark Fish is the type of person who doesn't know how to play Survivor, and as a result, he goes into like a Tasmanian devil-esque frenzy, where he's like, okay, well, this leak is happening, so let me do this, and then it causes like three other leaks to pop up, where, yeah, his leadership is just so questionable. I mean, listen, we're Team Sibu here, so of course I totally was, you know, feeling him when he calls out Mark for basically being like, yeah, you know, before the challenges, we talk at camp about like, hey, we have strengths and weaknesses, and then you make completely different decisions there. But yeah, Mark, I'm not sure what's going on here. I think he very easily knows he's in over his head in more ways than one. And considering the one thing that he has to do now, which is just to like coach the team in challenges he's still failing at.
You can tell Corne and Mark are very much like, I wish I'd watched even one episode of the show before I came on, just to get like a sense a little bit of what it was like. A couple of Mark moments. So one that I found really funny was that Kalani came to him asking to delegate tasks because like the workload is uneven. This feels like, okay, Mark, this is literally your job. It's like some of the biggest benefit you can actually give to the tribe. It's easy to do. And he gave her like so much pushback on it. Like he eventually does it. But he's like, oh, you tell them. And then if there's conflict, come to me. Like, why would you want conflict to possibly pop up in your tribe? Like, everyone's playing the game against each other for a million rand. There are hierarchies within that that make it difficult to tell people what to do, especially as we've talked about from certain demographics. You are the leader who has no stake in this. Like, definitely go tell your tribe what task to do. Like, did he just not want to get up? I was so confused about why he gave her so much pushback on this. When it was like such a benefit he could give to the tribe. I was so confused.
Fine, I have to go to the bathroom anyway, so I guess I'll hold this group meeting. It was so strange. Like, it's clear he does not want to be leader of this tribe, I think, to this point, but he's like, all right, I guess I'll try something. And then, but the tactic that he tries is like, I agree, he's not passionate about the stuff he should be passionate about. And then, as we see with Sivu, he is passionate AF about the stuff he should not be passionate about.
Yeah, so the Sivu stuff, like, I was so team Sivu, but like, emotionally so, because what Mark has done by sitting Sivu out when he feels like he'd be good at this tribe is, I mean, this good at this challenge, is made it a certainty that he has to compete in the immunity challenge. But as he said, he's only just learned to swim. It might be a swimming challenge, and now he can't sit out of it. Like, to give your team member so much anxiety that tomorrow will be an immunity challenge they have to swim in is obviously really bad leadership. Like, I'm sorry that I have to tell Mark Fish that. I know that he was like a professional sports captain. I'm confused about why this isn't obvious. So, like, you're in the wrong. Like, the thing you're upset about is that Sivu acted too emotionally in front of the other tribe at a time when where your tribe is about to compete. Like, let's hype them up. Okay, I think what you want to do is, like, publicly apologize for putting your team member in that position. And then maybe afterwards be like, hey, Sivu, just, like, I know I did the wrong thing. Just, like, maybe try and keep, you know, the kind of where we're at the moment in mind. If we're about to do a challenge, like, let's try to keep everyone on track emotionally, but like, hopefully you won't be in that position again, because I'm really looking at what I did wrong. I think that's what you want to do, but instead he's like yelling at Sivu in front of everyone because Sivu was publicly he called him a spoiled little brat, like, WTF. And then the thing he's upset about is Sivu being publicly upset as he publicly berates him. Like, I know they were different things, but you have to see like some sense of the irony there.
I wonder if Mark was seeing a golden opportunity of like, okay, great. If I blame it on Sivu for being so disappointed to demean the tribe, maybe no one will look to me of like my horrible leadership was the reason that we lost this challenge. I mean, it also shows how, for many reasons, what he did in his professional life does not translate to Survivor. Because yes, a captain uses strategy to sort of like put people in certain positions and employ certain strategies. But you know that it's going to revolve around a limited set of skills around soccer. The thing about Survivor, and as you brought up here, is that every challenge could be completely different. And so it's not like, okay, I need to use this person each and every time, because not every challenge is going to be the soccer challenge. You know, there was a very good chance that like, hey, this challenge would benefit from someone with really long legs and someone who is like very flexible. You know, let's put Sivu in there, because there's also a chance that there won't be one that tests long legs the next time. But I think Mark is sort of going in here like, okay, I'm going to get your strengths and weaknesses. But he's used to getting strengths and weaknesses from like a list of 5 possible challenges, as opposed to now a list of like 20 different challenges that now he has to juggle.
It would have been really helpful for him to watch the show beforehand. Another thing he says that was funny was when he says this is a team game. When it, like, it definitely is not. Like, it's explicitly not a team game.
I will say, though, in spite of, yeah, the sort of like childish attitude, ironically enough, that he shows Sivu, I did think it was a fun line when he said, if your talent is holding a ball on a stick, then you should be in the circus.
Yeah, I mean, that's someone like, it's a funny line, but he's like completely missed the point. The point is that you've put a new swimmer in a position where he might have to swim. And that's like really bad leadership. Like, why are you fighting? He's fighting with Sinet in these 2 episodes, Kilani, Sivu, like, you're not playing Survivor. Why is there so much conflict? There's no stakes and your role is easy. Come on, yeah, like, I mean, it shouldn't be that hard.
I mean, it's weird to say that, like, the tribe rebels against Mark here like we did on Celoton, because, like, Mark has basically, like, withdrawn himself from any strategic stuff whatsoever. So,
yeah,
like,
that's
I don't think he wouldn't even vocalize who he would want gone at this point. So it's not like, it really does seem like, you know, he is the monarch, but like they are the cabinet, you know, because you tell them watching a lot of The Crown, like,
oh my god,
the ones
I just thought of The Crown,
the tribe is the one that's actually like wielding all this political control, but Mark is sort of seen as like the spiritual leader who actually doesn't do that much in the day-to-day.
Oh my god, you're right. Utaro is exactly like The Crown. I'm now casting people in my mind. It doesn't make sense though, because Shona should be the queen. She's not on that
yeah
tribe.
Well, all right, so let's talk about this, because I know that you wanted to talk about some David and Shona stuff, speaking of episode four, because we've been so like depleted of David Shona content in these two episodes, but we got it right at the end there.
Yeah, the scene between David and Shona was just completely iconic. So another thing that was funny about David and Shona just before that was like when she was tasked with explaining the split vote to him and he like did not get it.
Yeah, and he got it wrong, right? He ends up voting for Philip when he shouldn't have.
No, I think he was on Philip. I think that
no,
was
I thought, right. I thought it was supposed to be 6-3, I thought it was. And it ended up being 5-4.
So I think that the vote that we weren't expecting was that Moira voted for Philip and it made it 5-4. Like, I think they actually split it perfectly, because if they do it 5-4, then it just means that Xavier and Amasha can't play the idol Amasha and then flip, because then it would be at 2-2. So that's the right move there. I mean, if they wanted to kind of protect against all three of Philip, Marsha, and Xavion flipping against them, they would have had to just split their six down 3-3, which they didn't do, because then probably Philip would go home with Xavion and Marsha's vote. So I think they did it as perfectly as they could while still getting Marsha out, while still kind of protecting against any possible insurgency, expecting the three probably wouldn't all come back together again based on like the conflict that there's been there, and protecting against an idol. I think they split it pretty perfectly.
I think what makes it a little touchy with 5-4 is that it would have been a 1% chance, but there could have been a chance that for one reason or another, whether incidentally or purposely, you know, Xavion and Marsha convinced like one of the Rugrats to jump over and vote off Philip instead. Right. Like that was the whole thing with why Mookie goes instead of Alex in Fiji, was that Alex was the intended target. But because the votes were so close due to the split, he was able to just like he himself was the one person to flip over. So, again, and the Rugrats had sort of an iron grip on it. But I do think objectively, 6-3 would have been a little better than 5-4, especially to your point, knowing that Philip, Marsha, and Xavion are not coming together anytime soon.
I'm smiling because I'm remembering us like arguing about these like completely meaningless split vote mechanics all the way back to 2018. But like, I still disagree that like 5-4.
It's good to be back, right?
Yeah, like 5-4 was the way to go, I think, because they put David, who's probably most likely to flip on Philip if he's given the chance, and they put Xavion and Marsha like all on Philip. So I think that they kind of protected against that. I mean, we talked a lot in the Plurality Vote podcast about kind of the dangers of splitting the vote and if people will come up against you. But like, honestly, the majority did amazing. They had the read and the power, and they achieved it in getting all of the minority to just vote against each other. I think that they protected pretty well against it, and that their read was correct. And I think that they were trying to make sure that it wouldn't be Philip unless Marsha had the idol, and they did pretty well in that. They put the right people on Philip. I thought it was well organized.
Yeah, I mean, I think the linchpin wasn't even like David and others hopping on. I think it was making sure that Xavion and Marsha were the ones that were on the Philip plan in the first place, right? Because again, otherwise, if they were supposed to be voting for somebody else, they could very easily join whoever else was supposed to vote out Philip, and then Philip gets the majority of the votes. But
yeah,
especially, you know, and that was part and parcel with, I can imagine that was part of Xavion's like extremely overeager willingness to be accepted as part of the tribe. He's like, yeah, sure, I'll vote out Philip. And as a result, they really had nothing to worry about, because the biggest flippers or biggest wild cards, which were the two of them, couldn't do anything feasibly with their two numbers.
Yeah, they were already expecting the wild cards who could vote Philip out to be voting for Philip. So like, who else was going to go to Philip? I thought it was well done by the majority. So Shona and David. So the debacle that is this pair, the idol argument that they had at the end of the second episode that we watched, when she's calling him a little flipper, they're like goading each other. Like, it seems like the big argument is over whether he'll show her the idol. And I understand that that does have some relevance to it, because you can steal the idol, so she could just go take it and it would be technically hers. But I think like he didn't ever seem like reticent to even show her the idol. Like, he eventually shows it to her and it's totally fine. She goes from like so angry at him to like, and it was so toxic, to just like being totally fine. She's like, it's pretty, isn't it? I just like love the calm down.
She tries to smooth it over, but David does not forget. I mean, they essentially make like a blood oath here, sort of blackmailing each other of like, hey, if you bail, I'm going to screw you over. We didn't talk about this last time, but can we talk about the aesthetic of the idols for a second here? They seem like weird, like, hand-painted ceramic pottery you, like, find on the side of the road while you're driving down the interstate in the middle of the desert.
Maybe that's where they got it. Like, maybe they're trying to bring attention to those
local artists. Yeah. I'm just intrigued by, like, where that plays into the pirate stuff, you know?
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's in the sports theme, because we don't know, because it's a hybrid pirate sports theme. So you gotta,
I'll be honest, it looks like a bowl that you smoke weed out of.
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
I mean, maybe it's dual use. Maybe that's why they're like, nobody's going to steal it. Everyone's going to be so chill. You know, everyone's just going to be too mellow with the stuff that's inside that idol that nobody's even going to care about stealing it out of anybody's hands. Everyone's just going to lay down, listen to some music, talk about how pretty the stars are. And you'll forget that you wanted to steal the idol in the first place.
I never know where your mind is going to go, but I'm always like grateful to be on the ride, you know?
Okay, well, that's very, I'm very happy that you're on the ride with me, Shannon. But this is great for so many reasons, because like we talked about before, like this is a pair who seemed to be okay. Like they were a little bit of an odd couple last time, but they had this like tempestuous trust with each other. But like essentially Shota's telling David like right now, well, I'm going to admit to you, I don't trust you at all. Can you show me the idol, please, by the way, just sort of as an addendum to that?
Oh, and they're like screaming at each other. And so he says, what are we, fools or heroes? And now I'm like really upset with myself that I didn't introduce you as the fool to my hero.
Oh, I mean, that would have been true in so many ways. But now I can't wait for like Survivor 43 fools versus heroes.
Yeah. Oh, I should have done that as an introduction. I also had to text my mom and ask her what snai means, because he said, if you snai me, I'll snai you. It's Afrikaans for cut. And I'm enjoying how all of the things I know about Afrikaans are from 2 years of schooling I had before I moved and just picking up random words and watching Survivor South Africa. It's a slow education, many, many decades in the making, but I'm going to get there eventually. I'm going to be fluent, but I'm only going to know like very strategic words.
Yeah, well, this is the practical application, right? And I also love that logic as well, right? Of David being like, well, if you cut me, I'll cut you. And it's like, well, technically, if she cuts you, you'll be gone. So unless it's like a jury vote, you can't do anything, man. To use a pirate nomenclature, dead man tell no tales.
Maybe he'll like actually cut her.
Yeah, I don't know. But also we should mention David decided to, maybe this is something as well, when you know that an idol can be stolen, wrap it in your grody ass underwear and no one will get within 10 feet of that thing.
We did get a question about this, and it was something that my husband Peter was very much like, why is the idol in his underwear? My question is, how many pairs of underwear do you have? Like, if that's where his underwear is, is he wearing?
I think he only had one, if you get my drift.
I always do. You don't have to ask. Like, I get it.
Resource allocation is key in the game of Survivor. And it's like, okay, well, I could wear it around the island, or I can use it to wrap my idol up. Let me go commando right now.
Maybe he thinks because idols can be stolen, no one will steal it if it's in his underwear.
Yeah, exactly. Like, right. I'm sure you could do something like, I don't know, you could like put the idol up your nose and then put it in there. Like, who wants to touch the booger idol?
I'm not going to follow this train of thought further.
Yeah, let's not go to any more bodily holes.
Yeah, there are clearly other places we could take it, and I'm not going to. I want to say that David is good at knowing when he's on the out. Like, it sounds like an insult, but I mean it as a compliment. Like, he's actually pretty good at knowing when he's being ostracized, and like he was very wary of Philip creeping into the alliance. And like he was right, because now it is kind of between him and Philip, and like David versus Philip was like a long running storyline over these two episodes. Like, he couldn't do anything about it, but that was a good read that wasn't good for him.
You know what I realized this episode? David has big Jane Bright energy from Survivor Nicaragua, because I feel like both he and Jane, you know, he's a farrier, she was a dog trainer. Like, they're both used to working with animals more than people. And so they're sort of like more of a recluse. Their personalities don't necessarily fit in with the people around them. They're both sort of like ornery, yet sometimes happy older people. But it's interesting, you know, Philip is trying to make a move here by throwing David under the bus. And I think it's just the matter that like David socially is not really getting along with anybody, but I guess getting along enough. But yeah, like you said, I good on him at least for acknowledging the fact of like, okay, something is clearly off. Though I do see, I wonder if Shona's point, you know, between the suspect of him having the idol and him just like not fitting in with these younger people, I wonder what sort of the balance is as to why David feels as on the outs as he does.
I think he just doesn't fit in. Like, I think it can sometimes be that simple. I mean, he came out of the gate pitching plans to everyone, trying to align with everyone. He doesn't seem to like really fit into the group. He is a bit of a different demographic. Like, I just don't think that he fits in. I think it's that simple.
Yeah, well, then good on him, at least for being able to get into the Rugrats for now. Which, I mean, I guess we should also sort of segue to talking about Celoton and this first vote. Because, I mean, we spoke about it before, but, like, Xavion, good on you. You brown-nosed the hell out of yourself and showed off those gleaming muscles, but I think he's in a pretty good position right now.
Yeah, I think Xavion did well. Not at first, as we said. He came out super aggressive, like, why should I even try for this tribe? And I was like, oh my god, Xavion, please. But then, like, I think once he'd slept on it, he was kind of realizing where he should go. Like, he refused to give a name. He told Graham to just kind of, like, tell him the name when it worked, which was obviously the thing to do. The thing I worry about for Xavion is that his strategy is to get to the merge and then win out. And I feel like having that strategy from the first vote is really difficult.
Yeah, all right, here's my plan to win 1,000,000 rand. I'm gonna win, make sure they keep challenge me around because of my physical aspect. Then I'm gonna win 8 immunity challenges in a row. It's never been done before, but I can do it. Yeah,
bad
that's
one.
His plan, definitely, you know, short-term versus long-term game. His long-term game is still a little shaky, but at least in the short-term game, I like the position that he's in because, yes, he had to vote out his closest ally, but it was almost sort of like Chris Doherty voting off Sarge.
Yeah.
Where, like, he loses power in the number of people that he can directly influence, you know, end up leaving, because now, you know, he is a pretty good physical asset to a tribe that is now on a winning streak. And also, just by purely, like, existing, the Rugrats Alliance has now had cracks start to emerge, namely, you know, Philip, who I don't even know is technically part of the Alliance, being on the outs. We can certainly talk about the choice to put the votes on Philip instead of Xavion in the first place. Not to mention David is sort of not fitting in socially well. And then you could always turn to, like, if you had to, people like Shona as, like, well, if we're really losing, let's, you know, get rid of her like we will the first time. I do think that Xavion has, well, though he doesn't really have any direct power, like someone like a Graham or Moira, I think he has firmly, like, snuggled himself into a pretty good position. Even though, like you said, once it hits the merge, he's going to have to find a better, more complicated plan than just win challenges.
Yeah, I mean, voting out Marsha is what we spoke about a lot in the Persuasive Psychological Principles podcast, which is the foot in the door strategy. Just like, once you've worked with someone, they're more likely to work with you again, and just kind of getting in there in a way that doesn't seem like it should matter because they have the numbers anyway, but it just kind of makes a statement. And the way to make a statement on Survivor is, like, with your pen and parchment. So I like that he did that. I mean, he lied to Marsha's face with aplomb. And I think that what he does have is time, because they're not getting rid of him anytime soon. And they were never going to be splitting the votes on him and risking that he could be the one that goes if Marsha has an idol. So he has the time to kind of work through what he's been doing now, which is just kind of taking a step back and kind of sucking up to the majority. And I think that he's doing it well as of now. Like, talking about foot in the door, I was, you know, which is obviously something Philip managed to do in the first vote when he found out that, you know, the new plan and went with it and voted out Ashley. Like, I was trying to work out, in the Philip versus Marsha debate, did Marsha screw herself more with the whole, like, she apparently lied that the old people are being targeted? Or did Philip, like, save himself with the awareness to vote with the Rugrats and get himself in there? And they were like, well, he showed more loyalty than Marsha. We have more of a working relationship with him. Or, like, was it both things?
Yeah, so it's interesting because I don't know, because Alltop sort of vocalized, like, well, the reason why we're getting rid of Marsha is because she was spreading this rumor that, you know, that Alltop and I think Moira were trying to get rid of the older people to sort of, like, get David on her side. I think that just, like, was extra credit onto the fact that they were already targeting her, right? Because she and Xavion were the only two people who didn't vote with them last time, and Xavion was someone that they wanted to keep around as an asset. So I think, like, her number was up already, and this certainly didn't help. So I guess I would give, I don't know, I would say maybe, like, Philip gets more credit for bringing himself into the Alliance than Marsha does for, like, screwing herself over. You know, like, she definitely worsened her position, but her position was already at the bottom, so she just dug herself deeper.
Yeah, and I'm just really happy with the way these two episodes a week have worked out, because often in, like, Australian Survivor, they do it on a weekly basis and they'll kind of create, like, a little bit of, like, a thread or a storyline or, like, a structure to it. Whereas, like, we've just happened to do this, and episode one last week didn't have a tribal council, and episode one this week was, like, a pretty boring vote, and then, like, the second episode's really been, like, where the drama is. So I feel like it's gone very well from a podcast point of view, which I appreciate. A couple of quotes I really enjoyed, other than just the colleague one. I really like Xavion in the challenge when they're digging, going, "We're enjoying this. We are enjoying this."
I love, like Celoton has sort of become summer camp in the past couple of episodes. So I do love, like, you know, their kumbaya stuff, their whole like boom, you know, cheer. And yeah, the whole Xavion, like, camp counts, like, "We're having a great time. We're laughing. We're enjoying ourselves. This is great."
I think that should be the new tagline of our podcast. We are enjoying this. There's like so much force to it. Another incredible quote. I had this in my notes and I had to go back to make sure he'd said it to their faces, which he did. Corne says after they win the reward challenge, "It wasn't the strong ones who helped, it was Shona and David."
Oh my god, even Corne did not learn his lesson. Well, speaking of Celoton, I mentioned this before. Let's bring up the choice of the Rugrats to split the votes in this particular way. Not even from a numbers
perspective. I don't think we're going
to
agree on it. I don't think we agree on mine.
Well, no, I'm just intrigued by the choice for them to choose a secondary target as Philip instead of Xavion.
No,
right?
Because
again, you'd imagine that, like, okay, Marcia and Xavion are on the outs. You just split the votes between them, maybe make them vote for each other. Why do you think they chose to throw it on Philip and essentially show Philip, like, yeah, you're on the bottom, dude?
But Philip knows he's on the bottom. I think, like, Philip was pretty lucky to vote with the majority. He was probably told by, as we are assuming, like, one person, like a Moira, for example. I don't think he was, like, brought in by the group. Like, Philip would know that he just basically tagged on to the end and was just trying to save himself, and he has no really room to play, and he basically has to take what he can get. I mean, he should be thanking his lucky stars, and credit to himself for reading it right last week and getting in for the first vote. But, like, he's lucky they didn't just vote him out. Like, they owe nothing to him. He's not in the six, and he is on the bottom, and he knows that. They can't go for Xavion because, again, like, the biggest, strongest guys are protected by that. They can't risk that Marcia has an idol and they've lost Xavion. They probably would lose a lot of challenges. So they don't go for someone within the Rugrats. I think, like, Philip's not a rug rat. He's more like a rug. I wasn't going to say rat.
No, he's not a rug rat. He's Spike the dog, right? Like, he gets involved in their adventures, but, like, he's not a baby proper. He's an animal.
Yeah, he's not a baby. That's great. That line's out of context. We are enjoying this. Yeah, he knows he's on the bottom. Like, he's not in the alliance. He's just lucky to still be there. I think he should count as lucky star. So I think that, well, it was the right decision.
You know what would have helped? If maybe there was something that Philip had as a secret that he could bring to his tribe as sort of a gift and, you know, really boost his position in the tribe, perhaps.
But you think he should have been doing more with the sugar cane? Like, he's very much just, like, just eating the sugar. He'll yeah, be like, the Titanic is sinking and he's on it just eating sugar cane.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like it's tough to compare him to Jericho, but, like, look at what Jericho was able to do with a jar of cookies. Philip has a jungle full of sugar cane and he's just gnawing on it all day long.
Is that going to be enough to save him, though? I mean, it's not his sugar cane. Like, those were Jericho's cookies. Like, the sugar cane belongs to all of them. Like, anyone could stumble on it at any time.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying, like, that being said, like, what he did with Moira was interesting. I'm intrigued why he didn't do that with more people, you know?
Yeah.
Like, why not do that with someone like Graham, who, you know, has a lot of position? And, like, that's what Jericho did, was he sought out people that were in powerful positions so that they had good bonds with him, so that when it came to getting rid of people, they'd be like, no, I feel good about Jerry. Let me keep him by my side. He could do that with other people as well. And for some reason, he, like, stopped with Moira and decided, like, you know what? I'm more for Philip.
Well,
I'm going to keep celebrating.
Philip is only doing it, like, one vote at a time. Like, he's not trying to bring himself that much deeper in the alliance. Like, he's just trying to, like, now, like, so he, like, got past Marcia. That's done. Now he's trying to just get past David. He's, like, throwing David on the bus and, like, fighting with him. And, like, we don't know that that's not working. Like, David feels like he's on the outs, and, like, he might be. He doesn't know that David obviously has an idol, but I think that's his game plan, is more just, like, get through vote by vote until he can get to, like, a swap or emerge, rather than, like, trying to, like, sugarcane his way into actually being, like, a firm part of the majority.
Yeah, I mean, it's that short-term versus long-term, and so it's much more risky, but we'll see. I mean, if he does end up making it to a swap, I think he could very easily slip through, and that makes him, you know, a possible very interesting wild card if he, you know, ends up swapping into very interesting numbers and he has the chance to really go either way.
Yeah, I mean, I still think I'm interested to see where he goes with it. I was just really happy that Celoton won that last immunity challenge because I didn't really want it to be David or Philip, and I also was just really interested in kind of seeing the dynamics on Utara. So, TBD, I mean, I would kind of be into seeing a swap sometime soon. There's been three votes. You could probably go a vote or two. I don't know if there are any swaps on the season. No spoilers.
Okay, you don't want me to say anything?
Definitely not. No, that's, like, way too big for me. I just want to see it play out. Yeah, I don't want to know what's happening.
Well, speaking of what's happening, because Shannon, I teased for you last time. I said that, you're going to find out that champion means maybe something different. It's a really a catch-all term in more ways than one. And we got our first, you know, big sort of other champions twist of the season, which is that Cordae and Mark are not the only coaches. We've got some assistant coaches coming in.
Yes. Right. And again, this is the sports side of the Pirates sports theme that I think is less my vibe. I did actually Google. I did my own Googling, like how far away roughly this is. And it's like it's a far way away from South Africa to bring out someone for a challenge. Cochrane style.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe Jimmy Tao like heard that Mark was competing. Like, I don't know if they had history together. You know, Mark says at one point, like, oh, you don't want me on the same tribe as Jimmy Tao.
I'm really interested in the backstory to that one line.
No, I'm sort of obsessed with this because, well, first off, A, I apologize for spoiling this. This will not be the last.
No, it was already
coach.
In the next time on.
Yeah, exactly. So like there's gonna be quite a number that appear throughout the season here. But what I love about it is what we spoke about last time was how much this blows up in the show's face, right? Of like, all right, here's the soccer challenge and you have a soccer star on your team and they still lost.
Yeah, I mean, he did score a goal. It was very much the soccer challenge and then no one was scoring. I'm sorry to all the soccer fans. The reason I've never been able to get into the sport is I'm like, let's get something
yeah,
happening.
I don't think we even needed the defenders. Like, just have people try to kick it in net from like several feet away. That ended up proving as much of a problem initially. I thought that was an interesting challenge too, how like there was strategy in that, like, you could almost purposely knock off one of the defenders and then that frees open the spot so people could try to kick the balls in as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to just, like, basically be schooling a lot of the actual captains and what should have been done, but what you want to do is you want to line up all your best players so that, you know, a couple of them are getting the defenders off and then you're, like, capitalizing on that time. I don't remember what it was, but I remember one of the defenders fell. And then the next person to kick was David. And I was like, oh, well, you just wasted
yeah,
all that time.
Poor David, who had to do like the granny kick and like kicked it directly to Steven, like they were playing catch or something.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it's confusing the captains with all these sports challenges and sports players because they don't understand that it's not sport. But like, I understand that their signals are getting crossed because like for Mark, so Mark, as we've said, has said this is a team sport, which it isn't. And like in soccer, if you were to bench someone like Sivu, for example, and then your team wins, like that's still good for Sivu. Like he's on the bench, but it's team as well.
Right. Like this is still the team win. It's not like, you're safe for the moment, but it's not necessarily like, oh, everyone shares the win when you're sitting on the bench as well.
Well, it's just like if you don't have a chance to prove yourself and then you get voted out, but then your tribe wins, like it's still not good for you. Like it's an individual game. So I get like why the captains are confused about this. It's not a sport. It's actually like an individual game of Survivor, but they keep bringing out more sports people. So like you can see why their brains are confused of whether this is a sport or Survivor.
Yeah, it doesn't help, right? They're like, oh, here comes this famous athlete to play a very specific sport, but the Survivor version. I did think it was interesting how even, you know, outside of the strategy or lack thereof from the coaches, they still also did have some dual aspects, like the fact that Cornet and Mark had to compete in like this little mini challenge to even get Jimmy Tao in the first place. And I will, you know, again, spoiler alert, that's going to happen with like every assistant coach challenge is that they're going to have like a little mini duel to determine who gets the player.
I can't tell you how little I care about that. Like, look, it's a waste of time, but we have a ton of time, so I guess it's okay. Like, it's like I know the demographic. Like, I don't know who these people are. I get it. Like, I mean, if it was Survivor players, like that's something I could probably vibe with. If we had an hour 7 in every episode of Survivor, and they're going to bring out kind of Survivor legends, like I could be interested in that. So I see why they're doing it again to just like pull in the sports fans in the sport pirate theme. It's not for me. I will grin and bear it. through it.
I like it purely for the fact that, again, they are now like 0-2 and being like, look at these big sports stars. And then they just really do not deliver with the thing that they were brought there to do, essentially, in the case of Mark and Cornet, to coach. And then in the case of Jimmy Tao, to win a soccer challenge for a team. So I'm looking forward to whether this streak continues or whether actually somewhere, somehow this season, a professional athlete will actually help a Survivor tribe.
Yeah, I'm here for the like theme being rebuked at every possible turn. That is a funny through line that we should track. Like Peter said to me, he's like, so unfair that they had a soccer challenge when like Mark is soccer and Cornet isn't. I'm like, there's definitely a rugby challenge coming up. Like, hate to break it to you, but I'm sure that is like something on the card. So look, you receive and you lose at the same time. Like, we got this brilliant pirate theme. We have to put up with the sports stuff. It's not, well, obviously not our vibe.
And not to mention the fact, like, yes, on paper, this was a five hole, to use Amazing Race parlance, for Mark Fish. And Mark Fish might have been one of the worst performers in that challenge. Like,
he's a defender.
Sending balls sailing over the goal.
He is a defender, but you would think even a professional defender would be, like, better than random Survivor players at, like, kicking for goal.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you would think, like, I guess who was it? Like, I was very happily surprised that Bootlay had the magic boot, as it were, and was able to kick one of the goals. But, like,
well, that punt is right itself.
Yeah, for her to outscore Mark Fish was definitely very surprising.
Yeah. We've really ragged on Mark Fish in this podcast. Last week it was Cornet. This week, Mark Fish. Next week, we might go back to Cornet. Yeah.
No, next week's Jimmy Tao.
Jimmy was fine. Like, actually, so Peter was saying that he, like, looked up Jimmy Tao and he, like, found an interview where Jimmy said that, like, he found it a really fun experience and stuff. Like, this is so random.
I love Jimmy wearing the South African flag as a bandana. That was really fun.
Yeah. Wow. This is so out of my element. South African sports. I feel like maybe we should get my dad on the podcast. Because I did say to my dad, I was like, do you know Corné Kricha? Do you know Mark Fish? Like, I have to come to him every week and be like, can you explain this sports person to me? Like, my dad wasn't expecting to do this amount of work for this podcast for me. Yeah, I don't want to Google.
Maybe we should do, like, Sports Corner every week of, like, give me, like, the 30-second, the 30-for-30 on who Jimmy Tao is and, like, what we should know about him.
It's hard not being able to Google because, like, okay, so my dad is known to, like, if he doesn't know, like, he will make stuff up. So I don't know if I want to give the 30-for-30
It's like two truths and a lie as well, Bigden.
My mom always says that, like, when she was a teacher, she'd, like, go back and ask my dad stuff and he would tell her stuff and then she'd tell the kids and now, like, a bunch of South African kids, like, know the wrong information. So I don't know if I want to take, like, my dad's word on these athletes. And I'm taking my mom's word on the Afrikaans because, as you know, I'm trying not to Google things. So, like, this is a lot more work than I envisioned it being, but I'm glad we're all doing it together.
I mean, what's to say? Like, this is so educational in so many ways, Shannon. You're watching Survivor. You're learning Afrikaans one dripping word at a time.
Yeah.
And you're also finding out about sports in a country you used to live in. Win, win, win.
Yeah, but sports, like, that are relevant 7 years ago as well. Like, I'm just, like, very much in this vacuum. And I can't look up anything around it. It's kind of fun. But yeah, well, I guess we'll see how it goes with the sports stuff. Another thing we got, but it wasn't quite enough for me to do the new theme song, was like the Outsurance plug.
The Outsurance crate that seemed like they tried to come across like washed up on the island and Nico had to actually crowbar it open to reveal what was won.
They didn't give us enough about Outsurance. I was like, yes, a sponsor. You have an hour and 7 minutes. Spend at least six of them telling me about this brand. And they didn't. Do you think, like, this wasn't enough to do the theme song? Because I'm just, like, really looking for the opportunity.
I really don't think so. I think, you know, they didn't really, there's no slogan, right? Like, I feel like when the slogan is attached to the product, then it calls for the Biostrath Variety Hour. Let's not, you know, let's not pull the trigger too much until we have a genuine sponsor, people celebrating the fact that they now get to, you know, indulge in this product on Survivor South Africa season 5.
I'm gonna be mad if we never get a good enough opportunity in the season to use it. Just know.
Well then we just wait a few months and we do it for season 8.
I can't wait that long.
It'll just blink and it'll be here before you know it.
Okay, well, speaking of theme songs, I think that we'll get to the chili, and I don't think I said this last week, but take it away, Jacob Sega Weinstein and MC Color.
1, 2, 3.
That just feels good. Like, I want my Biostrath Variety Hour theme song on the podcast.
It'll come in due time.
Okay. I'm an impatient person.
Gotta play the long game, Shannon, not the short game.
Yeah, well, I'm very much like Philip. Like, I'm thinking, like, week to week. Okay, well, I'll start. I'm going to give 3 points to Marion, which adds to the point you gave her last week. As I've said, I've said a lot of it, but I love her approach. I like how she's hiding in Chain's shadow. I love her personal connections that she's making. I think she really got Sivu last week and he ended up being like a potential swing vote. A lot of great stuff from Marion. And then I have to give 2 points to Shane. You know, this was the vote that I'm really looking at, the second vote, which was much more interesting than the first that we watched in terms of this week. So he and Marion have really just set up their pieces so well. He's the leader, but, like, again, that's okay for where he is in the game right now. He always gets his way. He gets his names. He pulls people in himself. He has the idol. I didn't enjoy it the way that it happened, but he earned that. And, like, I think I even said last week, like, for me, he'd be my winner pick out the gate from the premiere. And, like, still this episode, I would feel good about him being my winner pick. And then I'm going to give a point to Sivu. To me, these three were very much the only three I was considering for points, and I just didn't usually know the order, because I didn't really feel like there was enough individually happening for me on Celoton in terms to give points there. But for Sivu, like, again, wanted by everyone. He initially actually found the idol, some pros and cons there, but he did do that without a clue. He must have a hell of a social game to be so wanted, and I think we're going to see next week how it works out with him having to be in the position where he betrayed just because everyone wants to work with him. I think he has a lot of excuses he can give to his old alliance. I think there's enough murkiness there where, as you said, it's not necessarily like he was like the one reason. Obviously, if he'd even flipped, it wouldn't have been a winning vote. So it's not his fault. There's a few kind of cross connections. It's a good situation for him in that murkiness. And I think that if things are a little fluid, what you want is a lot of relationships and he has them. So I hope that next week can kind of capitalize on that and not have it come back to bite him. But yeah, definitely 1 point to him. So those are my 3-2-1.
I like going 1-2-3 for some reason. I don't know. Maybe I like the build up to the big reveal.
The endless debate.
But maybe I'll actually just go right where you left off. I'm going to give 1 to Sivu. Because like you said, it's show rather than tell. If he's in the middle of everybody, if he has so many dates to the ball, you better know he's got the good stuff, you know? And I think that what Sivu's been able to do has been really great, especially when outwardly he may be perceived, again, as one of the physically weaker members of the tribe. He's been able to ingratiate himself really well into things. And the fact that he also has several outs, I think, moving forward, and at least the ability to find idols, maybe not keep them, but that could also mean a lot moving forward. And the fact that he was in a position of power, I'll put in quotations, because again, he really wasn't. At least he had a choice he can make this week in the first vote, says a lot. So 1 point to him. I'm going to give 2 points to Xavion. Because again, I think it was sort of like he came from zero to hero in a certain perspective. I think he basically did everything he needed to do perfectly of just basically ingratiating himself into the tribe. I think part of it was due to his own assets, for lack of a better term. But I think him getting rid of Marcia was the thing to do. And I think his work has really prospered for him in that now he's maybe third from the bottom, maybe, I would say, at least. But that certainly is better than the position he was in coming into episode 3. So I'm definitely going to give him credit for working his way into Celoton. And I'm going to give 3 points to Shane. I think Shane has 5, Marion has 4 now. So we want to keep them nice and close together. Because I think, for me, what bumps Shane above Marion this week is the idol find. There's a chance he could share it with her. But the fact of the matter is, especially with the rules this season, that idol is his, and that means a lot. And I could see.
It means nothing. It means literally nothing. Like, she could take it from him at any time. And it would be
right. So the fact that he's holding on to it now means, like, you know, he could do anything with it, especially now they're knowing that it's fleeting. So I think the fact that he is in a position of power, he is at least portrayed to us as the one that was really laying down the law of, like, okay, this person needs to go, this person needs to go. Seems like he was really one of the definitive voices to be like, Zan needs to stay. So he really sort of like had his cake and ate it too, in the form of that idol as well. Really good week for Shane overall.
Yeah, I mean, I think I gave Marion some points this week that you gave her a point for last week. I didn't want to give anything to Atara last week because I hadn't seen it play out in a vote. And you kind of gave her a point then for how she'd brought in Sivu. And I'm giving points now for those personal connections kind of across the 4 episodes. So I kind of see that. And I think, you know, Xavion reached out to us on Twitter. It was a really good sport about how badly we trashed his game last week. And he said he really wants the cap and scary note. And I was like, look, bribery will get you far in terms of just like giving us compliments, which he has already done. And I think also I saw a tweet from Marion. So like, look, if you tweeted us, you will go into high consideration for the chizzy for a prize
We never pride ourselves as objective here. Like, we appreciate the fact that people are listening, especially those that have gone through this beforehand. So let us know your thoughts, whether you be an alumni or not. But we appreciate everyone's who's listening. And, you know, it's a pretty tight clubhouse right now. You know, Graham ends up getting the goose egg this week because he had a fairly quiet week after a dynamite first 2 episodes. Now Shane and Marion are right behind him.
But Graham, like, he's doing the right thing. Like, what else was to do? Yeah. Like, he's still in control.
He came out hot and now he has cooled down to the point where we barely saw him these past couple episodes.
That's perfect. Like, he got himself in a great position. Now he's just like riding it out on top. It's great. He's in a perfect position.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's weird. You know, they went to tribal council on day 7. We are a quarter of the way through the season already, Shannon.
That is truly crazy. Like, I don't really understand the days and how it's working.
It was interesting. I was surprised that in episode 4 they did 2 challenges in 1 day. But it also, maybe it was just because since they were doing a quest for fire takeoff, they wanted it to happen at sunset, which I'm like, yes, nighttime challenges or like dusk challenges are fantastic. I can't remember if they did more 2-in-1 day challenges because they go to tribal council every other day or what, but it led to some really interesting timing in episode four, right? Like, we knew who won immunity halfway through the episode.
Yeah, they're doing a lot of, like, you don't go to tribal council the night you lose immunity, which they don't have enough days to do. I actually had a notice that they did two challenges in one day, probably because I just assume, like, nighttime has happened in between those things. So that's, like, a crazy thing to expect people to do. And then, like, Kalani was talking about how Zan had insulted her bed today, and I was like, wasn't that the last challenge? Wow, that's crazy that they made them do that.
Yeah, so they went back, they did the challenge probably early in the morning, went back to camp, you know, with Tara stewed for a bit, and then they had to be like, all right, I guess wipe that dirt off your chin and get back, because you're doing another challenge here for redemption.
That seems completely insane. Why is this 27 days? Like, it feels like it's just so rushed, and it's a regular amount of people and a regular amount of episodes of anything, like, a lot of people in a lot of episodes. Like, why didn't they just do it over 39 days? Confusing.
Yeah, I don't know. Was it a thing? I mean, you know, I think it was 27 days up to this point, I want to believe, for whatever reason, for Survivor South Africa. Yeah, it was 29 days for season one, and then 2, 3, 4, 5, it was 27 days. So
thank you for Googling.
I have no idea. A lot of international seasons, I think, actually sort of had been doing the less than a month period for maybe whatever reason. Maybe they thought that, like, you know, sort of rolling back the 3-day cycle to a 2-day cycle, like, made for just quicker turnaround, and so maybe quicker gameplay, but it does seem a bit frantic.
Well, I don't like it. And to get to the questions, we actually had a question that this might explain. Amy Chan says, why at the start of episode 3 did one of the champions, assume Mark Fish, think the other tribe might have voted out two people at the first tribal? They were like, yeah, we can't work out who's going to be sitting out because we don't know how many people to sit out.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know,
because Mark Fish has never seen Survivor. That's the answer.
That is the true answer. But there are challenges, though, right? Where there are, like, some challenges only require 7 people, right? Like, I remember the crate challenge in Survivor Heroes versus Villains. I remember Rupert sitting out, even though the Heroes tribe was down, because, like, for some reason, only a specific number of people could play. So maybe there was going to be a specific situation where that was the case. But I think the Occam's razor dictates that Mark Fish just had no idea how many people were going and what he had to do on that day.
I can't imagine Mark Fish being like, well, I know that usually we'd just be seeing out one, but don't you remember in Heroes versus Villains? Like, no, Mark Fish doesn't know.
Yeah. Can I also say that during that whole, like, I think that was like the South Pacific challenge, right, where they were sort of like reeling in the boxes. That puzzle that they did was pretty hard. Like, there was very little color on that vertical puzzle.
It was tough. I mean, I've been doing a lot of puzzles, and it's really all about the color. I don't understand how people who can do these puzzles where it's, like, all one color. That's not for me. Like, I can't do that.
Yeah. So, and it was interesting, you know, again, fun little cultural shout out with, like, oh, it's the puzzle that's just Changshi with the red fleet. But the puzzle itself actually just looked very difficult, because it seemed like the color on the wood was so dark that, like, it was difficult to make out the lines of the actual person himself.
The best part about the sports pirate theme is that, like, the puzzle could have Changshi or it could have Jimmy Tao, and you just don't know. Could be,
yeah,
either,
like,
one.
Oh, yeah, your reward is actually going to be on the puzzle, and you think, like, oh, it's going to say, like, a steak dinner, and no, it's a picture of Jimmy Tao, the soccer player.
This is so ridiculous that we've just accepted the sport pirate theme as if this is, like, a regular thing to happen.
Yeah, it's the sport pirate season.
Yeah, it's sport pirate season. I guess that's what we're watching. Speaking of, Donna McCarthy asks, is there any way you could make the castaways look more excited or anything but miserable to see all these sports stars?
Yes, if they were waiting for them at Applebee's.
Yeah, well, Mike, remember where you are. If they were waiting for them at Steers, is what I think you meant.
Yeah, I guess they had a steer, like, Jimmy Tao's waiting for you with a delicious Steers burger, they would lose their minds.
Yeah, don't be presenting me any more sports stars that aren't holding burgers. Like, that's an insult.
That's what needs to happen. That's what it is you need to have the sports star, like, with a reward, right? Like, oh, look, it's Jimmy Tao, and here he is with letters from home. Yeah. You know, like, give something to sort of grease the wheels a bit so people get more excited.
No, this is what it is. Here's Jimmy Tao, and he's here with letters from other sports stars, just, like, yeah, knife them where it hurts.
Writing words of encouragement using their own experience. They don't even know what Survivor is. We had to write in the show name for them.
That would really snide them from learning the language.
Truly snide.
Yeah. Okay, Constant McCormick asks, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much does Survivor South Africa love slow motion? It's a lot.
Oh my god. It's so, especially the soccer challenge was so OTT with the penalty kicks.
They love their slow-mo.
I guess they have the time to do it, right? They have an hour 7, so they're like, okay, we can stretch this out a little bit, people.
Just like a regular episode, but just with slow motion. Should be 42, just goes for an hour 7.
Yeah, maybe no, everyone's voices are not actually as deep as we hear it out, because they actually slowed it down to like 0.75 speed and everyone just sounds drunk and low voiced.
Yeah, okay, I think that's how we get it. That's how you get the time. I mean, that's what I think Australian survivors should know. That's how you should be getting time as well.
Exactly. Don't put in repetitive confessionals. Just slow everyone down just a little bit. It'll make them sound smarter and a little inebriated. And also, yeah, everyone will have like a nice, rich baritone voice by the end of the episode.
Just play it at 0.8. I think it works. More questions. Okay, we got a lot of questions about the underwear, but I think we've already talked about the underwear. Talos on Twitter asks, would you be interested in seeing one or both of the champions playing in an all-star season as a player?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. Immediate answer from Mike. Look, I already saw Cornet and it was Sam Webb, so no. Mark Fish, like, I'm a little curious. Like, to have this much conflict and drama for someone who's not playing and has the easiest role and is literally, there's no stakes for him. Like, I would be interested to see him actually have stakes.
I don't know.
He'd be fighting
like,
everyone.
Yeah, but I feel like Mark Fisher has like a Jeff Kent vibe to him in that regard. So it's almost like I've already seen that story play out before. I'm not really getting anything new from Mark in that regard if he were an actual Survivor player. What makes it fun to watch is the fact that he is in this very unique position where, like, he cannot be voted out, yet he has lost all control of his tribe.
Look, I'm not clamoring for it. I'm just saying if I had to choose between the two, I'd go with Mark.
I'm picking Jimmy Tao.
Yeah, honestly. And the fun thing is that we'll get more and more people put into this draft, and by the end, we can say who we'd most like to see on Survivor.
Ooh, all right, you know what we can do? So let's make, like, an assistant coach power ranking moving forward of, like, all these guest stars.
Okay.
Of just, whether it be, like, you know, potential as Survivor castaways, personality, etc. Jimmy Tao is, of course, uncontested number one right now because there is nobody else, but as soon as next week, we're going to have someone joining him to rank him against.
The fact that this could be a whole segment concerns me. That you know what's coming. I think that, and then whoever wins, we're gonna get a loved one's letter from them if we can. If we could get hold of them, maybe get LaRue to help us out.
Yeah,
I want
exactly.
A loved one's letter from whoever we think is the best assistant coach.
I really like that idea because, again, we're gonna deal with them throughout the season. We might as well have some fun with it.
Yeah, I mean, I actually got a really interesting statement on this, which is something I actually hadn't thought much about, which was bad. But Jeremy Hamilton says, it's an interesting tie-in to the season's theme, no, one of its two themes, Jeremy, to bring in guest champions to help in the challenges. I just hope they bring in at least a couple of women in this role during the season. Things are already feeling too patriarchal for my liking. And that is a good point. I mean, no spoilers, Mike, on whether they will. Look, three women have gone first. And
yeah,
even though,
and in a game that started with two extra men as well.
Yeah, and I think that, like, did it start? Didn't it have 20 people?
Well, it had 20 people plus two guys.
Right,
Mark and Cornet. So it's,
right,
so it's technically 12 guys, 10 women, and now it's 12 guys, 7 women.
I mean, I'm not counting Mark and Cornet as being in the game, but I think that even though we've rebuked kind of like the strength thing, there is a sense of that, like, patriarchy to it, and the fact that these captains do have control, and the fact that, like, they chose Xavion and Steven to be their assistants, like, there is a little bit of that coming through. And if it's always going to be, like, male sports stars that we're looking to get loved ones letters from, yeah, I mean, I think that kind of, like, inherently runs in, and it again, matters. Like, these things all kind of play into it. So,
yeah,
I'm interested to see how that goes as well.
Yeah, I'm at least what makes me a little hopeful is, again, like
that
you said,
when the, you know,
well, when the coaches are given control, like when they pick their sort of first in that second episode, like you said, they went for the guys because they're used to working with men
mm-hmm.
on a sports team.
Yeah.
What makes me happy, though, is that the majority alliance and both tribes are co-ed. So it makes me hopeful that we are not just going to have like a sausage fest, because I guess as the coaches lose their power, I do think the female contingent of the game tends to, you know, gain more power as well, which is very exciting because, yeah, I really don't like the fact that three first boots were all female.
Well, I mean, every single thing against us that is happening is just the incredible cast, less than I hate you. It's them kind of fighting against these things that are kind of constricting them. Like it's very patriarchal. It should be all strength. It's all about the team, and it's just the cast being like, no, it's not. So we've already seen them do that against strength. We've seen them do that against the team mentality and kind of having their own agenda in voting out whoever they want to vote out. And we have seen three women go first. So I don't doubt that this cast can get there where they do kind of even it out with the genders, but I think the game is set against them in that way. And it's just them working against it themselves, but they have done that because they're a great cast. So we'll see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the theme, is leaning towards that. That is something that is happening. Thank you very much for pointing that out, Jeremy. That was a great point.
Yeah, very much so. So we'll have to, we'll keep an eye on it. But I don't know. I feel I'm happy with the season so far.
Yeah.
I mean, look at get trash bags Zan out of here.
He's
ASAP.
A little Zan. He is.
Yeah, but he's a little Zan. But I do think that outside of that, there's a lot of like dynamic and electric gameplay going on with Bullet Trap. So the point where like I'm already excited for a swap and or a merge to have like Graham meet Marion and Shane, for instance, like to see exactly what happens there. Will they work together? Will they not? And so there's still stuff to play out. You know, these alliances are far from ironclad on each tribe. So as the game continues in episodes 5 and 6 next week, which we'll be covering, I'm sure there'll be plenty more movement than you might think at first approach.
I'm excited about it. Like, as I said, it was upsetting parts of this episode. I don't know, obviously, what happened with that, if there were apologies. I'm just watching it in like my little vacuum here where I can't Google things. It hurt to see kind of in that moment. But I don't want to, like, I'm still so invested in the rest of the cast that aren't
there.
No,
yeah.
One
bad, horrendous, stupid apple spoil the whole bunch.
And especially when he's wearing a shirt that says dope. Like, he's telling on himself. Like, we know what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, if you want to know who the dope is in the room, it's the one wearing the shirt, essentially, with the name tag of it.
Exactly. He told us. I mean, you can literally read it on his shirt. But yeah, I mean, I think we're still obviously having fun with it, having fun with the ridiculousness of Mark Fish, and then next week we'll go right back to just ragging on Corne and that rinse
yeah,
repeat.
Next week is Corne week? Okay, yeah. I'll make sure to put that in my notes.
Yeah, well, Mike, what else do you have going on other than just like ragging on captains of a sports pirate themed season of a show that aired 7 years ago?
that's only what I want to do. But I have been doing a lot of living in the past this past week, Shannon. So I talked about this last week, but officially myself, Rob Cicernino and Grace Leader got together for an edition of Outwit, Outplay, Outlist about some of the most iconic jury speeches in Survivor history. Unfortunately, a long lost art form in modern day U.S. Survivor. We went through, you know, the 33 seasons that it has happened in so far and talked through stuff that is remembered and quoted by Survivor fans even to this day. It was a very fun time. You can check that out in the podcast feed, or on the Rob Has a Podcast YouTube channel where there's a bit of a visual component. Of course, over on Post Show Recaps, I'm going down the hatch with Josh Wiggler. We are about to get into season 4 of Lost, which is one a sentimental favorite of mine. So I'm so excited to get into the weirdness of that season. And I spoke about this last week, but we are officially opening up the Bloom files this coming Sunday. Myself and Angela Bloom engaging in an X-Files rewatch/first watch podcast where every week she's going to show me an episode or episodes of the hit sci-fi series. I've never seen it before. She has seen it many, many times, and we give our varying opinions on that. We're going to come out with an intro podcast this Sunday that was very fun. And then I also appeared on the Kin Nation recap this past week talking about, you know, when you leave kids to their whims and they try to create a society, what might happen. And, you know, there were leaders this week that might rival Mark Fish in terms of ineptitude. And it was a very fun time talking with Rob and Phil Thompson. So a lot of stuff this week if you want to check it out. Otherwise, you can just follow the general shenanigans I'm doing on the internet at a Mike Bloom type.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine what the jury speeches that Mark Fish and Corne are going to give. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it might honestly be like Mark being like, do I have to get up and give a speech? Yeah. Like, why don't you just give a speech and I'll, you know, otherwise then they'll come to me if they like the speech or not. And then maybe I'll have to say something.
I really have to get up right now. I really have to get up to do this. Like, how much are they paying Mark Fish? You get up, you do your job.
Yeah. Well, the weird thing is, like, you know, again, when it gets to the merge again, it's a weird situation with the coaches, even weirder than it is now. So they're going to be in a very interesting position come merge, no matter what, and not just lying down a la Mark Fish.
I think that the way that it's gone for Corne with him just like being immediately voted against, like, I think that he's just going to be like, look, you guys just tell me who to vote for. Like, you do what you want. I don't have a say. Like, I think, I don't know if Corne is putting his foot down much anymore after how badly it went the first time.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe he'll just like be like, hey, Nico, can you pick it for me? Yeah. You know, like, who do you think? Let me consult with you. You're the host. You know this better than I do.
Sounds like Corne Week started early on my South Africa podcast for next
That's
week.
That's the tease for yes. Corne Week.
Well, yeah, follow me at Shannon Gates. As Mike said last week, I put up the Twitter question threads. I really like that we're getting some really great questions. Even this week, we're recording a little early, and so we've got some great questions. So thank you to everyone who's following along with us. I wanted to just remind everyone to subscribe to the feed, the International Survivor Rehab-Up feed and the Rehab-Up feed, where these podcasts are and all the game theory stuff coming up is. There was a little bit of a tease in this podcast about what's coming up next. So a lot of fun stuff happening. Thank you guys so much for being the heroes to our fools. We are enjoying this. Thank you guys so much for following along with us. Thank you, Mike, as always. Thanks to Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. And we will see you next time to rag more on Corne. Bye.
Australian survivor.
Survivor.
21 South Africans.
12 ordinary Australians.
16 New Zealanders.
20 federal.
Given the
swamalista. £1 million.
Million euro.
Million shkeli.
Aldi. Million rubli.
Tribe spoke. Tribe spoke.
Tribe spoke.
Tribe spoke.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.